one after the other after the other, we are told, accomplished what God intended for them to accomplish by faith. I don't know, as we read through this chapter, if you are able to kind of pause in your mind and in your heart long enough to kind of get a sense of what the writer is trying to express to us. Each one of these individuals that were named were real people. Real blood and flesh and bone. They had real pain and sorrow and affliction. They had real dreams and aspirations. They had real love for their loved ones and their families. They had the same kind of dreams and ambitions, hopes that you and I have in our bosoms today. They were real people. Not one of them was perfect. The great names that we read this morning in this chapter, men of God, men that have plowed the fields before us, men that in many ways have set the standard of obedience, of faith, of victory, of conquest. Think about the life of Abraham and Noah and Moses and Joseph. Think about the exploits that they accomplished. And yet, not one of them was perfect. If you were to look even casually at the record in the Word of God relative to the lives of each one of these men, you will find many, many examples of imperfection and a fallen nature resident in their lives. You can find fault easily with each one of them. They were all made from Adam's clay, as you are made from Adam's clay. And we don't have to look very far to find imperfection in your life. And you don't have to look very far to find imperfection in mine. We are all of a fallen race with the same fears and the same trepidations and the same weaknesses and the same doubt that these men experienced. And yet, in spite of their imperfections, in spite of their many mistakes and their sins and their shortcomings, each one of them fulfilled something wonderfully great for the glory of God and for the good of mankind. Each one of them, in one way or another, some to a greater degree, some to a lesser degree, but each one of them, in their own unique way, had the power of God upon their lives. And they accomplished the thing that God intended for them to do. Each one of them left a legacy for which future generations could build upon and could look to with encouragement. Each one of them provided to you and to me an example that we could follow in our lives today. It is not a mistake, it's not a coincidence that the Holy Spirit inspired the apostle to write this chapter in as much detail as he did, with as many people's names included as he did. And when he gets to the end of chapter 11, as we read, notice again in verse 32, he says, "What more shall I say? There's not enough time to tell you about Gideon and Barak and Samson and David and Samuel and the prophets. There's not enough time to tell you how they did this and talked about quenching the violence of fire, wrought righteousness, subdued kingdoms, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, waxed valiant in flight, etc., 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 on and on and on. And you and I can go back and read the record of the Old Testament and find out that historical record that God has given to us in His Word, and know that beyond the historical record that is left for us, there were many, many other things that they did and they accomplished which were not chosen to be recorded for us in Holy Scripture. What I'm trying to say to you is these were real men and women, real people, who, despite their mistakes, their sins, their shortcomings, their failures, their weaknesses, were able, with God's help, to fulfill the will of God in their lives, and they have left an everlasting legacy for believers throughout the ages to follow and to emulate. And then when we get to chapter 12, he summarizes everything he said afore by saying, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses." So great a cloud of witnesses. All of the ones that he just had named and many others that he had not. These are the witnesses that are looking upon us, their posterity. Those of us who are the children of faith. Those of us who claim the same faith that they claimed. We claim to love and serve the same God they loved and served. There is no difference in the God that they served and the God that we serve. The same one. We are compassed about with this great cloud of witnesses. All right? So what? What do we do about it? With this history, with this heritage, what is our response? The Apostle Paul says we should do three things in light of what others have done before us. In light, in view of their sacrifices, do you think that when they sacrificed their lives, their peace, their families, their futures, that they somehow loved life less than you do? Do you? Do you think they love their families less than you do? Do you think they love the security of life, the pleasures of life, the success of life any less than you do? No. They were every bit human as we are, with the same nature that we have, the same feelings that we feel they felt, the same aspirations, the same dreams, the same affections, the same ambitions. They loved it all equally with us. And yet, in the providence of God, depending upon what God had required of them at the time, they were willing to step out by, say it, faith. And do whatever was expected and required of them. For some of them, according to our text, it meant the loss of life. For some of them, it meant the loss of home. It meant the loss of family and friends. For some, it was the loss of reputation. For some, it may have been the loss of health. But they were willing to stand up by faith and do whatever it was that needed to be done in order to secure the blessings of heaven for their posterity. And now the apostle looks back and he says, here is your heritage, dear believer. Here is your ancestry. You don't have to go to ancestry.com to know your ancestry. Go to Hebrews chapter 11. That's your ancestry. So what are we to do? Three things. Number one, lay aside every weight. Number two, run with patience the race that is set before us. And number three, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. That is what is required of us. That is what is expected of us. All of history is looking at us. They are watching us. Tom Brokaw wrote a book a few years ago chronicling the exploits of the World War II generation. He called his book The Greatest Generation, and it became a bestseller. I'm not sure whether the World War II generation was the greatest generation of Americans. In my personal assessment of history, I believe that the founding generation was the greatest generation of Americans. There's no question the World War II generation was great in some ways. But when you look at the generation that currently exists, how do we compare? How do those who have gone on before us look at us? Sadly, I think what they see must disturb them greatly. I think they see a generation, and I'm not talking about unsaved, unchurched, unbelieving people. I'm talking about professing Christian people. They see a generation that is for the most part spoiled and lazy. A generation that for the most part wants to absorb all of the blessings that were wrought at the expense of someone else's sacrifice. And then whenever they have expended it all, spent it all, they are willing to dig a hole and borrow upon their future generations in order to please and gratify their own lusts. A self-centered, selfish generation that is willing to borrow against the future in order that they might be comfortable in the present. do these people not have children? Do they not have grandchildren? Have they not thought what is going to take place when the seeds that we have planted in this opulent, materialistic, selfish society has borne fruit, and it's the next generations that are going to eat that fruit? Are we like the Old Testament king who, when the prophet of God came to him and said, "I'm going to give you peace for the remainder of your days, but because of your sin, O king, because of your unbelief, O king, because of your disobedience, O king, I am going to judge your children and grandchildren, and they are going to die at the hands of their oppressors." Are we as that king who, upon hearing the words of the prophet of God, replied and said, "Well, at least it won't happen in my days"? It doesn't matter that my children and grandchildren are going to fall under the heavy hand of slavery and persecution. At least it won't happen in my days. Please tell me that we are not as this wicked king. Please tell me that our own comfort and our own security and our own peace and our own happiness is not so valuable that we are willing to deny our own flesh and blood the opportunity for a peaceful, safe life. Every generation, let me rephrase that, each generation must for itself make whatever decisions and sacrifices are necessary in order to procure the blessings of heaven for themselves and for their posterity. Each generation must do this. And the first generation that comes along and refuses to do this is the generation that will be the one which will dismantle the blessings of heaven and leave for their children and grandchildren a legacy of defeat and ruination. The seeds of these things don't happen overnight. It's not something that you do today and then tomorrow you see the consequences. The things we're talking about here are generational. Generational. It's what we do in this generation is what is experienced in the next generation. We're talking 20, 30, 40 years in the making. It's not something that's done overnight. Overnight. the history of the faithful people of God has been one of generation by generation by generation being willing to stand in the gap and do what God would have them to do. We could go on to post-biblical history, could we not? And we could talk about what happened in the early church period. We could talk about the great persecution that came after the church began. We know about it in the book of Acts, but it continued on after that. We could talk about how the generations of believers were migrating from place to place and how they were able to stand and withstand in the face of insurmountable oppression, persecution. But they stood. They were faithful. By faith, they preached. By faith, they served. By faith, they gave. By faith, they stood. And by faith, they raised their children and passed on that faith to them. You get to that period of the Dark Ages when Bible Christianity was forced underground. But those generations stood. You can go to some of the ruins in various parts of Europe, and you can find underground cities which were carved out of the rock under the earth. And when the Roman Empire was marching her troops above ground, squashing anything that dared to resist, torturing Christians, throwing them to the lions and the gladiators. And while it looked as if real Bible Christianity had been obliterated from the earth, in the rocks underground, they lived. They raised their children. They taught the Scripture to their children and grandchildren. And under the very feet of the Roman Empire grew the legacy of faith and hope and love that you and I now, I'm afraid many times, take for granted. And when the day came that the Roman Empire fell apart, in parenthesis, every empire is destined to fall apart. Every empire. Empire cannot sustain itself. Empire is not eternal. Empire is destined to fall under the weight of its own machinery. Every empire will fall apart. There has never been an empire in world history that has been able to sustain itself. Not one. And when the Roman Empire fell into 100 pieces, arising from the rubble were the men and women of faith who had never, ever bowed the knee to Caesar. And the legacy of faith that we read about in Hebrews 11 marched onward. And when that legacy of faith captured the hearts of our forefathers in Europe that brought the gospel of Jesus Christ to this land and created the greatest free country that the world has ever known, that legacy of faith marched on. And each generation stood. And each generation paid the price. I don't know how much history you read. I love to read history, especially American history. I love to read it. I love to read of the journeys, the pilgrimages, how that our grandparents were willing to launch out, knowing not where they went, knowing not what lay before them, knowing not whether or not they would even be alive the next year, in order to bring back news of what they had found. But they did it. And they stood, and they marched, and they dreamed, and they built. Were they perfect? No! They were no more perfect than the people of Hebrews chapter 11 were perfect. No more perfect than you're perfect. But they followed the call of heaven. They followed the call of freedom. And they stood and they sacrificed and they endured and they paid the price and they put their own feelings and their own comfort and their own success second. And they built and carved out of the wilderness the land of freedom that you and I now know as the United States of America. So what now? What do we do? We've had this rich legacy. We've had this rich history. We've seen what was done. We've read the price that was paid. Now, what do we do? It's our turn on the stage of life. We only have a few short years. And we will march off of the stage of life. And others will take our place. And they will endure or enjoy the fruit that we planted. Lay aside every weight and the sin. Look at it. And the sin which doth so easily beset us. Now listen to me carefully here because I don't want to be misunderstood. Many preachers have taught, and I have taught, and there's nothing wrong with this teaching to the extent as it goes. When it says, lay aside every weight and the sin that doth so easily beset us, and we have said, and I've said it, and again, it's right as far as it goes. What is the sin that does so easily beset you? And many books have been written on the besetting sin. And I've read several of those books. And they talk about how that each person, and the idea is that each person has an innate propensity for a particular sinful weakness. One man may have a propensity for the weakness toward alcohol. Another man may have a propensity of a weakness toward sexual immorality. Another person may have a propensity of a weakness toward greed or materialism and things of that nature. And they've said, we must lay aside that sin that does so easily beset us. And there's nothing wrong with that teaching. I'm not here to to try and rebuke that or to counter that. I believe there is truth to that. I do believe that people have varying besetting weaknesses. I think all of us would, if we look honestly into our hearts, would recognize that there are certain things that more easily capture us than other things. And what may capture one more easily may not capture another as easily. So I'm not here to counter that. But in the context of what I believe the Apostle Paul is writing, that's not what he's talking about. Now listen to me very carefully, because this is crucial. This is crucial. And I think that many Christians have missed it. Lay aside every weight and the sin that doth so easily beset us. Lay it aside. What is the sin that doth so easily beset us? If we are going to run with patience the race that is set before us, we can't do it with all this weight on our backs. When's the last time you ever saw a race, a track meet, and one of the runners had a 20-pound bag of rocks on his back trying to run the race? Silly. You're not going to try to run a race carrying a whole bunch of extra weight. You'll never do it. If we're going to run with patience the race that is set before us, we've got to get rid of the weight. Well, what is the weight? The weight is that sin, that besetting sin. Well, what is it? In the context of this passage, it's not talking about our individual proclivities. This isn't talking about whatever that propensity that you may have toward a particular weakness might be. That's not what he's talking about. Again, you have to take this in context with chapter 11 and everything that came before it. By faith, Noah, by faith, Abraham, by faith, Moses, by faith, Joshua, by faith, Joseph, by faith, Enoch, by faith, Gideon. What's the sin that does so easily beset us? The sin is unbelief. That is the besetting sin. The sin of unbelief. Refusing to believe God. Refusing to trust God. Ladies and gentlemen, every time we choose to not stand where we should be standing, we are exercising unbelief. Every time we choose to not do what we should do, we are exercising unbelief. And one of the things that really disturbs me about the attitude of Christian people all over America today is everywhere I go, I hear Christian people, I hear preachers talking about how that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether we stand up. It doesn't matter whether we fight. It doesn't matter whether we do this or it doesn't matter whether we do that. Things are going to get worse and worse. There's nothing we can do about it. It's too bad. It's too big. It's too broad. It's helpless. It's hopeless. Oh, shut up! We serve the same God Abraham served. The same God Moses served. Every one of them had the same circumstances. It was always foreboding. It was always ominous. It was always negative. You mean to tell me you... let me tell you what. When Moses and those 2 million Israelites got to the edge of the Red Sea, they had the mountains on either side, they had the Red Sea in front of them, and they had the Egyptian army pouring down back of them. I guarantee you, Moses didn't get out, okay folks, let's all get out our copies of How to Win Friends and Influence People. Our positive mental attitude is going to see us through. I mean, come on. They were always outnumbered, outgunned, outmanned, out-equipped. But by faith, they stood. By faith, they conquered. By faith, they gave us an everlasting legacy. So what are we to do? Lay aside the sin that so easily besets you. That sin of doubt and unbelief, and we can't do it, and it's all over, and we're not strong enough, and we're not big enough, and we just don't have enough help, and it's just all bad, and we're just all going to die. Yeah. You keep that attitude, and that's exactly what's going to happen. You're all going to die. And so are your children, and so are your grandchildren. They're all going to die. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin of unbelief that besets you so easily. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us. We are not required to run Abraham's race or Moses' race or Joseph's race. We have our own race to run. It's our own race. It's a unique race. It's our race. Nobody else can run it. The next generation can't run it. They'll have their race to run. We have our own race that we've got to run. And let's run the race. Get rid of the weight. Get on the field, run the race. Don't quit. Don't be discouraged. Run the race. And then thirdly, verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher. I love that. Finisher of our faith. He didn't just author the faith. He finished the faith. Which means He'll take us all the way to the finish line. Looking unto Jesus. You see, that's where some of you have blown it. That's where you've blown it. You're not looking at Jesus. You're looking at the White House. You're looking at the news media. You're looking at those dopes we call congressmen. You're looking at the economic circumstances. You're watching Wall Street. And gas prices. You're like Peter, who, when he was walking on the water, all of a sudden started looking around and said, "What in the world? I'm out here on the Galilean Sea, and this is a storm going on all around me. What in the world am I doing here?" And as soon as he got his eyes off of Christ and got his eyes on the storm, he sank like a rock. And that's what's happened to a lot of Christians. They're sinking like a rock. Because their eyes aren't on the Lord. Their eyes are on the circumstances. On the surroundings. On the enemy. You say, "Well, it's never been this bad." That's what they said back then. "Well, it's worse now than it's ever been." Yeah, they said that too. Yeah, but they never had to put up with... Yeah, they said that also. Different names, different times, different places, different dates. Same thing. You have the devil and his crowd that are trying to destroy God's people. And you've got God and his children who are either going to keep their eyes on Christ and stand and do what is right, or they're going to get their eyes on their circumstances. They're going to put on the weight of doubt and unbelief, and they're going to fall under the heavy hand of oppression. But the choice is ours. And if we do lose our liberties, our freedoms, our way of life, our form of government, the things that ensure our peace and happiness, we will have no one to blame but ourselves. Because the same God in heaven who answered the prayer and came to the defense of Abraham and Moses and David is the same God in heaven who will answer the prayer and come to the defense of his children today, who will be faithful to lay aside the weight of unbelief, to run with patience the race that is set before us, and who will at all times keep their eyes on Jesus.